Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune into Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio.
Greetings to the brightest audience in the country. Welcome to Real Science Radio. I'm Bob Enyart. If you think about the kinds of people in life who you'd love to talk to based on their profession, at least for me, it's folks like scientists and astronauts, cold case detectives, archaeologists and historians, people who make a living by collecting and weighing evidence. Well, there's a cold case homicide detective, J. Warner Wallace, who has taken his skills of observation and analysis of the evidence and applied those to the question of the entire universe. Where'd it come from? Do we find God's fingerprints anywhere? Well, what an honor to welcome to Real Science Radio J. Warner Wallace, author of God's Crime Scene, A Cold Case Detective Examines the Evidence for a Divinely Created Universe. Detective Wallace, great book. It's a whodunit. Welcome to Real Science Radio.
Well, thanks for having me. I just try to apply some native skill sets you learn working investigations and see if I can figure out a way to apply those and to actually examine the universe as a crime scene. So I'm glad it was helpful for whoever reads it.
Well, we not only got a copy from the publisher, but now we've bought another. My producer, Larry Wolf, will be going through it at his church's small group Wednesday meetings.
That's so great.
And that was at the request of the group because they saw it as he was reading it, helping me prepare for the interview. So, Jim, at the start of this interview, I think the audience will enjoy our discussion even more if we take a moment to get to know each other. I'd like to share with you some of our criminal justice efforts, and we'd like to hear a bit about your background before the book. So maybe you first.
Okay. I was a guy who just really didn't have any interest at all in anything of God, either Christianity or anything else. I was not really raised in an environment where we talked about this stuff much. Neither one of my parents were Christians, and I didn't have I could think of any Christians in my family. Mm. And even, you know, as far as even a couple of generations, or even aunts or uncles. So I didn't really have anybody who could, share what the claims of Christianity were even all about. And so at the age of 35, I was very committed to my worldview. And, you know, by that time, you're pretty settled in my profession. I was working as a police officer, and I was working investigations. And my wife was somebody who had been raised as a cultural Catholic, more or less. Mm-hmm. And although she had a good experience of it, we never, ever talked about it. And she never, made a stand for it. Didn't really know what it taught. It was just more or less knew that God existed, or at least that she felt that he did, and just was happy to be quiet about it. And so she was always thinking, well, we have kids. Should we raise our kids in this? I mean, is this something that, you know, she had been exposed to the Catholic Church as a child? So she was interested, and she wanted to go to church, and I would go maybe in the last few years before we really started attending. I might go on holidays, right, as an unbeliever. My dad does that even today.
Happy
to go because he thinks it's a useful delusion.
Right, Christmas and Easter, C&E Christians.
That's right.
Or churchgoers, and see what it's all about.
Right, and I would never have said I was even a Christian, like a church-going, C&E Christian. I was not even, I was just somebody who was going because my wife was interested in going. Mm-hmm. It became kind of like part of the cultural routine of those holidays, right? So I was probably about 35 when we decided to visit a local evangelical church. It was the first time I'd ever been in one for anything other than like a wedding. So we go into this place, and the pastor talks about Jesus as though, number one, he really lived, and number two, that he's super smart. He's the wisest sage upon whom all of Western civilization's moral ethics have been based, and here I am a police officer enforcing the moral ethics of our culture, and I was intrigued by this idea that this Jesus guy might be the source for those, and I decided to go out and buy a Bible and take a look at the teaching of Jesus, and that's what really got me started.
Well, I thank God for that pastor and his willingness to share what he has learned and the way lives are changed for eternity. Before I tell you a little bit about us, let me ask you this. Why do you think there is this phenomenon of a fascination in the public with forensic crime shows, crime investigation. There's a long history of this. It's just not with modern cable TV. Why do you think it's there?
Well, I think, like, of course, you know, we're in a particular season in our culture where, you know, law enforcement is not necessarily the most, you know, venerated vocation you can think of right now. But I think traditionally people are interested in mysteries and solving mysteries. We all love that. We love puzzles. We want to see what the puzzle looks like when it's assembled. Mm. We love mystery stories because we want to kind of try to see if we can figure out how it ends before it really ends. Mm. And I think that these investigations, the kind I work, are really incredible examples of, you know, a skill set that most of us employ as amateurs. We do it all the time, right? I mean, you do it when somebody makes a statement you're trying to test to see if it's true. You do it when your kids give you an excuse for why they're late. You do it when you are reading a book and you're trying to get to the conclusion, you know, before they do.
Yeah, right.
I was right. See, I told you, and that kind of thing. And so these kinds of investigations are where that form of thinking is realized. If you always think, if I had the skill set of a detective, what would I better know about the world around me?
Yeah.
And so I think that's why it's
so solving mysteries. It's obvious that we have this incredible curiosity within us, not all equally, but many of us, we're incredibly curious. And that points us to the direction of the question of where did we come from? But I think there's also this aspect of it that many crave to see justice, even when there's injustice all around us. So even if it's only a movie or a TV show, where the bad guys are really bad, and in the end, they get it, and they get it good. It's like a preview for Judgment Day. We're just thankful to see justice being done, and if not in the world around us, at least on television.
Yeah, I think we have this sense of wholeness that we seek. Mm-hmm. So when anything is broken, we want to fix it. If it's a broken relationship, we want to see a happy ending. If it's a broken persona, we want to see healing. If it's a broken lives because of a crime, we want to see that solved. And there's always this hope that we can return to wholeness. And that's what I think sometimes these investigations are about. And these families you work with, who I work cold cases, just unsolved murders, and then sometimes these families have been waiting 30 years for somebody to come, and of course you can't fix it. You know, you can't. There's no such thing as closure. People think they strive for it. You're lucky if you get justice, but you'll never get closure. You can't return it to whole. I can't bring the deceased back to life. But in the absence of that kind of wholeness, I think people want at least the justice aspect to be solved. So I sometimes will tell people, I will warn them in advance as a family that, look, we need to have a worldview that helps you to find wholeness and forgiveness and a return to this kind of thing, because all we're going to do for you in this world is help hopefully get legal justice, but we're not going to be able to do much more than that.
Mm. And I remember that Jesus said, if he repents, forgive him. So as a pastor, I also pastor Denver Bible Church, I would throw that in the mix also, as we've done over the years, 25 years on the air, 5 days a week on a 50,000 watt station. You know, we've had murderers from jail write in handwritten confessions to their crimes, and families that have, you know, loved ones murdered. We are involved tangentially with something that was your career, Jim. So aside from hundreds of hours of jail ministry, I'd love to tell you three quick things about our efforts in criminal justice. On Court TV, I got to give a Bible study on the death penalty during the sentencing phase of Scott Peterson's trial.
That's awesome.
And it was just so important because the death penalty is the foundation of the gospel of Jesus Christ. And so many, even Christians, believe that it's barbaric or unjust. So that's one thing. On many news networks simultaneously around the world, we burned O.J. Simpson's memorabilia on the steps of the L.A. courthouse. I don't know if you recall this, a little footnote in history, but we had purchased his NFL Hall of Fame induction award and the jerseys that hung in his Brentwood mansion. And at auction in Hollywood, and the next day at high noon, before a dozen network TV cameras, we had spent about $16,000 on the whole mess, and we burned it all while we called for reform of our criminal justice system, with many networks filming and reporting that we described it as It's no longer adjust the system. Now it's just the system. So this has been a focus of ours for many years. The criminal justice system is failing. And then the third thing, I have conducted seminars all over the country from Honolulu to Pittsburgh. We call them God's Criminal Justice Seminars. And we've had many law enforcement officials in attendance, city prosecutors, federal magistrate, law partner of a sitting state governor, a detective or two. I don't remember any defense attorneys, but one of the things we learned in the seminar, which is at our website at kgov.com/crime, is that two or three witnesses to establish a conviction in the Bible does not mean eyewitnesses. And thankfully, most murders, they tend to act without an audience. And the Bible explicitly shows that physical evidence and circumstantial evidence could count toward the conviction of a suspect. So that's to give you an idea of what we've been doing for 25 years regarding criminal justice.
Very cool.
So, can we talk about your book, God's Crime Scene? Some people wonder right off the bat about the intriguing title, because whether or not the universe has an intruder, but why did you end up calling it God's Crime Scene?
Well, the idea here was that we could actually investigate the scene of the universe using some of the tool sets that you use when you investigate crime scenes. So we're not really suggesting here that God has committed a crime, but instead that we could use the same approach, which really isn't about intruder investigations. You know, there's four ways to die. Only one of them involves a murder. There are three other ways to die. So the question becomes, when you walk into any death scene, how do you determine if you've got a crime here? Because it could be a natural, it could be an accidental, it could be a suicide. Those are ways that which you can die in which you're the only person who has to be in the room. Mm. Those three ways to die require no one from outside the room to come in the room at all. You can do the entire thing by yourself. And so the question for most of us working these kinds of cases is a simple skill set. Do we have any evidence? Can we explain everything in the room by staying in the room? If we can, it is a good chance it's one of the first three kinds of deaths, because you don't need anybody from outside the room to be there. Mm. So if you've got a gun in the room next to a dead body, and it happens to be his gun, who he's owned it for years, it's been in the room for years, and there's no evidence of an intruder, and it's his fingerprints and his notes laying next to the body suggesting that he wrote it before he died, well, it's going to be one of the first three kinds of deaths, here probably most clearly a suicide. But if you've got somebody else's gun lying in the room, and you've got evidence and bloody footprints leading out of the room, well, now you've got to go outside the room for the best explanation. Mm. And when you have to go outside the room for the best explanation of the evidence that's inside the room, everything shifts, because now you're in that fourth category where, you know, you've got evidence of an intruder, and intruders really change everything. Intruders are what turn death scenes into crime scenes, and what turns that sense of curiosity you might have about why somebody might kill themselves or die naturally. Well, once you've got an intruder, you've got to change that sense of curiosity into a sense of urgency. And that's what we do in death scenes. We're using this simple technique. Can we explain everything in the room by staying in the room? And I thought you could apply the same approach to the universe. Can I explain everything in the natural realm by staying in the natural realm? Or is it the better explanation, a cause that's outside of naturalism, outside of space, time, matter, and the laws of physics?
So, Detective Wallace, the way you think reminds me, I've read most of what C.S. Lewis has written, and the way you think reminds me a lot about the way he thinks. I realize that's quite a compliment, but it is, and it's well deserved. So the universe is the room that we're exploring for the evidence, all the evidence that it offers, but some of that evidence points outside the room.
Right, and that's the problem. And I think, as a matter of fact, I've identified 8 pieces of evidence in the room. And we've got to explain those 8 pieces. And that burden of proof is on everyone equally. So if you're going to offer that you hold a position of atheism, well, then you've got to explain those 8 pieces of evidence using nothing but what's available to you as an atheist, which means you've got to explain them using just space, time, matter, and the laws of physics and chemistry. So whatever it is you encounter, you got to stay inside the room to explain it, and all you have available are those limited attributes, those limited qualities of the universe, of the natural universe. And that's the problem. And I think if you look at that, I could have made a list of 12. Now, when I first started doing this, I had a list of 12, but I kind of pared it back to what I think are the 8 essentials. I think these are the most important pieces of evidence in the universe that everyone has a duty and obligation to explain. Mm. And that's why I think this is an important, and regardless of where you fall on this, everyone owes it to themselves to be able to offer what their explanation is for these 8 things.
Including, for example, that the universe has a beginning. Let me ask you, if you might take a moment to share with us, at the opening of your chapters, you'll present a past homicide scene where evidence was collected, and you use that as an analogy to delve into this looking for an intruder to the universe, and whether there's evidence.
I did that on purpose because I know that some of these concepts are not just difficult, but they might seem a little bit esoteric, you know, in the sense that if I'm going to be talking to an audience, a lay audience, about the origin of the universe, well, I'm going to have to, you know, read a lot in order to be ready to even talk intelligently about that. And then if I'm not careful, as I kind of re-throw it, I'm going to throw it in a way that nobody can actually understand it. So I thought, let me make sure that we find analogies that are we use with jurors and do this like a crime, like a real jury trial. We would simply not just have an expert come up and testify about these things. You confuse the jury. We're going to find a way to ask the expert about analogies and metaphors to make it clear to the jury. And I try to do the same thing in each chapter. As a matter of fact, one of these, for example, in our design chapter, where we're talking about the appearance of design in biological structures, which virtually nobody argues. Everyone accepts that. They all stipulate that the appearance of design.
Well, even the world's most famous atheists, who are very aggressive atheists, like Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking, they have acknowledged, Richard Dawkins has said, that biology is the study of organisms that appear to have been designed, as you report in your book. And Stephen Hawking says the same thing about the physical universe, as do scores of physicists. So I'm so thrilled you brought this out in your book.
Well, this is one of the reasons why we make sure we claim it the way it is actually stated. They would say it's the appearance of design, but they would say it's not really attributable to an intelligent designer,
right?
Just the appearance of design. So I'm okay with that. I think that's fine. That's fair. We can start there. The question then becomes, though, how do we determine if it really is a designer? Now, that's something I've thought long and hard about, because when I came out of my undergraduate work, my bachelor's degree was in design. Mm. And my background was in the fine arts and in different kinds of graphic, industrial, interiors, you know, all kinds of different forms of design. And then I ended up getting a master's degree in architecture. So if I go back and I look at all the artwork I did in my undergraduate work, from paintings to two-dimensional design, if I go back and look at all the models I built of buildings, I worked professionally in architecture for 3 years in Santa Monica, if I was to go back and look at all those projects, I think each of us would look at those and say, that's clearly the product of a designer. That building did not naturally come together by some effort of matter on planet Earth, you know, impacted by the laws of physics or chance. That looks like it's designed. Well, why do you think that? Well, I had a crime years ago. It was a cold case that I picked up in 2003 that was committed in 1979.
Oh, my.
So I was well behind the crime to even begin.
Yeah.
But at the scene, the killer panicked and left a device, a homemade device that he had created to do the murders. It was a garrote. A garrote is two handles and a piece of wire between the two handles. It's a strangulation device. In his panic, because she started to scream, he did ultimately kill her, but she screamed first, and so he panicked and left in a hurry and forgot his garrote. She had rolled over on it, and he couldn't find it. When the officers got there, they collected it right away. They recognized this is something worth collecting. Mm-hmm. And but of course, the question is, why would they think, aside from its location, there were a lot of things in that room they didn't collect. And if you look at it, it's pretty rudimentary. It's just a couple of wooden handles, a wire strung between them, that kind of stuff. That material, for example, was available in the bed, in the box spring. It was available in the plant sitting next to the bed, had a wooden dowel and wire holding the ficus tree up. The question became, I think is a reasonable question, is why do you officers think that this is a designed weapon? And especially since she wasn't ultimately killed by the garrote, she was actually stabbed to death.
Oh.
So the question becomes, why would you collect this? Well, because it's a weapon. He created this weapon and brought it with him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, I get that, but I want you to tell me, what are the design attributes of this garrote which convinced you it was designed by somebody? And that's something, if you got to stop and think about that. Well, And I actually identify from my design work as a designer 8 attributes of design that are available when we look at anything that's been designed by intelligence. And I think we use those in the crime scenes all the time to decide what is worth collecting.
Of course.
And we actually can apply this to biological structures to see if the most reasonable inference is design rather than chance or time or the laws of physics and necessity of natural law that would cause this to occur. And so I think that process, like all my cases, is about a cumulative circumstantial case. And by the way, when I say circumstantial, most of your listeners probably look at that and hear that word as pejorative, right? It's just circumstantial evidence. But
not
there
our,
are only 2 forms of evidence,
Jim,
as you know.
Jim, let me just interrupt. Not our audience, just so you know. We have the brightest audience in the country, and we know that circumstantial evidence can convict a criminal of a crime. But go ahead. I like your point.
Yeah, I think there's only 2 forms of evidence, direct evidence and indirect evidence. Everything you might find at a crime scene, everything you might develop as an investigator falls into those 2 categories, period. There's no third category. And of those 2 categories, indirect evidence is also known as circumstantial. And only one thing qualifies as direct evidence, and that's eyewitness statements. So everything else I find at a crime scene, everything else is indirect or circumstantial evidence. And we have jury instructions in every state of the union in which jurors are instructed by jury instruction that circumstantial evidence is to be treated with the exact same weight as direct evidence. You are not to give direct evidence more priority, more merit, more consideration in your deliberations. You are to give them the exact same deliberation consideration. And that's something that's powerful once you hear it, because you'll hear in the media all the time the expression, it's just a circumstantial case. You never hear, it's just an eyewitness case.
Yeah, right, exactly. In
fact, why is that? Because you have people have a faulty notion.
Faulty notion, yes.
Of what circumstantial evidence is.
In fact, the physical evidence and the circumstantial evidence could often be way more certain than the eyewitnesses.
I always say this. I would much rather have a circumstantial case than a direct evidence case, because an indirect evidence, you know, witnesses lie. And you have to take the extra step to test your eyewitnesses. You don't have to do that with indirect evidence. I mean, indirect evidence is laying around the scene. You collect it all. You make inferences based on the indirect evidence. The indirect evidence, the DNA, the fingerprints, they're not trying to deceive you. But witnesses often do try to deceive you. And if you don't have a system in place by which you would test eyewitnesses, you can be deceived. I've been deceived.
Yeah, what a great point. We have an article on our website for a couple years now that we're going to have to add a link to your book. It's kgov.com/forensics. And in that article, we make the case that the creation movement, your book falls into these 2 categories of criminal investigation and the creation evolution debate. And those are 2 of the main themes of our talk show. So it's just perfect for us. But on that page, we make the case that the creation movement has got it wrong, and we're part of the creation movement, but they have it wrong when they treat badly the historical sciences. And they suggest that only the observational sciences are real science. And so we point out that forensic science has taught the world that when a scientist looks at the evidence of a scene, he can often, using reason and logic, careful deduction, he can understand what happened more clearly and more certainly than people who actually witnessed the event. So I think it's wrong for creation scientists to act like forensic science is a stepchild of true science.
Well, and I can tell you this, that when we do cases, and I've done, you know, so many of these in front of juries, and these are pretty involved cases, we are going to use empirical sciences when we bring in experts who are going to test either certain materials, test certain ballistic materials, test certain serological materials, blood and DNA evidence, saliva, things like this. And so you'll have a point, but in the end, you have to make an inference which is rooted in something beyond the physical test. The science doesn't say anything. Scientists do. But in other words, we can do these tests,
yeah,
and we can produce data. But the data is silent and it's benign. Somebody has to interpret the data. And the problem with that, of course, is the interpreter is not without presuppositional biases. And so if you're committed to a certain end, you can find a way to interpret data, and we see this all the time. Defense attorneys, for example, when they follow us, we spend 5 weeks in front of a jury making a case. The defense attorney does not typically, and I can say in my cases, they very seldom introduce any new evidence. Instead, they introduced experts that reinterpret the evidence that we entered. So it's not as though they're looking at, I've got new DNA. No, they're just going to bring in an expert who's going to find a way to reinterpret what we presented as our evidence, which goes to show you that the science is relatively benign. What happens is that scientists make inferences based on the actual data. So it's important for, I think, people to recognize that this always happens, especially if you've got a well-paid defense attorney. He's going to bring the best paid scientists that he can find. And they're probably going to be much better in terms of their pedigree than your county expert that you got for free as a prosecutor. This guy is going to be somebody who's worth the money. And he's going to come in and say, their experts are wrong about this. Same evidence, same data points, but we're going to find another way to interpret it for you. And so, again, that demonstrates the fact that we are dealing with interpretations more than we are with raw data sometimes.
Detective Wallace, in the Bible, Jesus didn't always have the most favorable things to say about attorneys. And I think the example you just gave is perhaps one of the reasons why. If you pay somebody first, an attorney, they'll take your case against perhaps the innocent victim. Whereas if they paid them first, they take their case. And there's something just so terribly wrong.
Well, I can tell you how I kind of view this, okay? And I talk about this in Cold Case Christianity. I think that there are three kinds of defense attorneys that I've dealt with. And I've got friends who you would love. They are committed Christian thinkers, very well educated, and who have worked as defense attorneys. Now, let me tell you why. And I think sometimes we have this kind of false notion that you have to be on the prosecution side in order to, you know, hold this. And who in the world would defend guilty people? Well, let me just tell you what I've discovered.
Yeah.
There are three kinds of defense attorneys, and they're all true believers. You do have defense attorneys that are true believers in the client they're supporting, they're defending. They truly believe, this guy didn't do it. And I mean, I'm sure that not every client they defend they might feel that way about, but they'll find somebody, especially like, for example, if you're with the public defender's office, you just have to take the next guy up. But there are times when I've dealt with defense attorneys who were great people who truly believe that their client had been falsely accused. And that does happen. There are people who are falsely accused. Sorry, it does happen. So it's important for us to have true believers out there who will stand up and defend falsely accused defendants. The second kind of true believer is somebody who maybe doesn't think that their client is innocent in this case, but they are true believers in the system that requires the defense of the accused. Because in order for us to do this job well, even the guilty have to be defended properly. If you look at it from a purely prosecution side of it, if you have an improper defense, that thing's going to get overturned. So you want defense attorneys who will do everything they can to defend
properly
their client.
And the audience knows, so I might as well tell you, I mostly disagree with that. I mean, there's a little sliver of truth in there, but I think it's mostly a justification for our system, and our system is exceedingly corrupt.
Well, let me just finish my three on this, and then you can kind of give your two cents. This is just based on my, you know, 30 years doing it.
What's your third? Yeah.
So for the third kind is the people who are true believers in the money, and so that the money is the tail that wags the dog. So that there are people out there who are in that category, and I'm not going to say there aren't. But these are the three kinds of true believers. Now, if you wanted to argue about what percentage these fall in, okay, no problem, we can do that. And I've worked with attorneys who are in either one of those three positions, believe me. So it can be frustrating when you got the true believer in the third category. But what I find is, having done this now and having watched the way that cases are tried and then how they're appealed, and we've never lost an appeal. We've won all these both in trial, and we've won them all in appeal.
Congratulations.
But we understand what's required of defense attorneys to make sure we win it in appeal. We want them to give the most robust defense they can, because when it goes to appeal, there'll be not a single thing they can say to overturn it. They got a great defense.
Yeah.
And they happen to be guilty. So they lost.
So it's more than a quibble, but with your second category, I grew up going to actual criminal trials, pretty severe trials. My uncle, Adolf Galluccio in New Jersey, was one of the most prominent criminal attorneys. And he would get mafioso types, rapists, murderers, and so on. And after years of this, he's said to me, Robert, you know, I'm Bob Enyart, but he'd say, Robert, I no longer know right from wrong, which is clearly true. And he had no end of clients who he knew, this man is a rapist. This man is a murderer. He did everything he could to get them acquitted. He often succeeded. He became very wealthy, and he fits in with the whole class of attorneys who are wildly wealthy, who are sort of like your third category. But I think on Judgment Day, we're going to find out that the attorneys who worked to knowingly acquit a rapist and a murderer, that they will be found guilty as accomplices after the fact by God, because the important thing is not the process.
Right. Well, I think in the end, let me just close it with this, because I think we're kind of chasing a rabbit here. But I think that for me, I agree with you. I've worked with attorneys just like that, whose total goal was to help the bad guy get off knowing he's I think they've been complicit with it.
Right.
So I think in the end, if they're in that third category, that's a motive issue, and God knows the motive of the heart.
Yeah.
At the same time, I have worked with a number, who I can name by name, who have been believers who thought they were doing the right thing. Now, we could argue back and forth about whether that's true or not.
Sure.
But there are motives. They would never take somebody who was they thought was guilty and then would actually want to help them to get. No, that wouldn't be the case. They take who they think. I mean, they might be naive about it. They might not know all the facts that we know.
Right.
But I can also tell you from the prosecution side, it doesn't matter to me which of those three categories you're in. Because if I do my job right, no matter what you do, you're not going to win.
Right.
I'm going to win. We're going to win.
That's
because
great.
We happen to have the truth.
And I appreciate that confidence very much, Jim. So, and also, I'm glad you mentioned Cold Case Christianity with J. Warner Wallace. That was your first book, and so we highly recommend both books. Could you share with the audience the website for your latest book? And we're just about out of time.
Well, you can find all my work at coldcasechristianity.com. Of course, there's a God's Crime Scene website, but it points back to Cold Case. And at coldcasechristianity.com, what we're trying to do is provide people on a daily basis with either written material, an audio podcast, or a video that makes the case either for the existence of God or for the reliability of the New Testament.
Mm-hmm.
So God's Crime Scene, for example, you could probably use that book as any kind of theistic believer to make a case for the existence of God. But that won't turn the corner and help make the case for Christianity. That's what we did in Cold Case Christianity.
I know we said we're just about out of time, but let me give you one detail from O.J. Simpson's case.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you mentioned the garrote and the analogy of these detectives find this, it's just normal material, but they recognize that this was designed for a purpose. And where we have atheist and secular folks all over the world that become apoplectic when someone claims they could detect design. And for example, arrowheads collected by anthropologists, or Mount Rushmore, which is obviously designed, or even when atheists are listening to the stars to try to find a designed signal coming in so they can say, oh, look, we just heard from aliens. It wasn't natural. It was a series of prime numbers or something.
Right.
Our ability to recognize design is so obvious. We experience it at every moment throughout the day. And atheists almost universally deny that it's possible, which is hysteria on their part. In O.J. Simpson's case, this is like related to your garrote account, the defense attorneys were almost mocking the 911 operator who testified that she was on the phone with Nicole Brown Simpson, and then the phone gets put down. She dispatches the police, and they say there's a woman being beat at this address in Brentwood.
Mm-hmm.
And so they grilled her, and you could hear in the recording, you could hear Nicole being beat. You could hear it. And they said, how do you know what might have made that sound? Couldn't a phone book hitting a piano make that sound? And she felt so bad. And she's like, well, I guess it could have, you know? I guess I really didn't know. But of all the millions of actions that could have made that sound, she picked out the exact right one. And so our ability to understand evidence is inherent in who we are, that we're created to know the truth. But it seems like people who have an agenda, whether it's a badly motivated defense attorney or someone trying to reject the existence of the Creator, they'll look at the most obvious evidence and they'll say, well, that's absurd. How could anyone claim to see design?
Right. Well, a lot of, again, what we talked about is that this is what the, so the defense will raise the issue. Couldn't it be something else? And anybody who wants an alternative explanation will raise that possibility. And then it's up for us as the evaluators to determine which of these two explanations is most reasonable. This is abductive reasoning, right? Which is but comparing the evidence of what was heard with the alternative explanations. And I'm okay with that. I'm okay with everyone throwing every possible explanation on the wall they want to throw up. Because in the end, we're asking jurors to look at that list of explanations and decide which explanation is the most reasonable given the evidence we have.
Yeah.
And that's a fair way to approach it. I think I probably fault more on allowing jurors to do their job. Now, that's why I always say, though, that what determines whether or not you win or lose cases is not the opening statement, and it's not the evidence show, and it's not the closing argument, and it's not the jury deliberation. It's jury selection, period.
No,
you pick the wrong jury, you're not going anywhere.
And you just offered another condemnation of our criminal justice system. I don't know if you realize that, Jim, but whether a man is convicted or acquitted of murder should not depend on the output of a relatively anonymous, completely irresponsible committee. Because once that jury breaks up, there's no accountability. They're virtually anonymous.
Right.
And they could, because they hate the police, they could let a murderer go.
Of course, the problem is that we have a process in place, right?
Yeah.
Where we have 26 exceptions each that we actually use. And both lawyers get to vet through that audience of 70 people to find the 12 and the 4.
Yeah.
The 12 in the box, the 4 alternates.
Yeah.
And so if they do their job right, which is an incredibly important part of the trial process, that voir dire process,
yeah,
we end up with good jurors. Now, here's the other problem. I've seen professional jury systems or established fixed jury systems in which the vetting is no better. Now you have a bad jury that does several trials, or you have a single judge. You're going to allow the presuppositional bias of one person to make the decision.
So we advocate,
you're right, it's not perfect,
no,
but I think it's actually not bad considering where what the alternatives are.
I think I was called for jury duty just last week.
Mm-hmm.
I almost missed the show, but just made it. And at least, I tried to count, at least 15 times, we were told you get to watch a video ahead of time, hours of, you know, they're telling you what to think about the system. We're told it's the greatest system in the world. It's not perfect, but it's the best system in the world. That's probably what the Mayans said as they were plucking the heart out of a victim. You know, well, it's not perfect, but it's the best system in the world. But what I thought at the time was maybe they mean we have the highest paid attorneys in the world. Maybe they mean that by that phrase. Because we have among the world's highest sexual assault rates, highest violent crime rates. I mean, pretty much you have to go to war zones to find nations as crime-ridden as we are. We have between 1 million and 2 million people in jail at any given time over the last 20 years. I think our criminal justice system is a colossal failure. I know this is tangential to your point, and I'm sure you're inclined to defend the system, but it's hard for me to just let those comments go because the system is a catastrophe.
Yeah, no, I'm not sure what I can say to you on that. I mean,
well, you could disagree,
My only experience is the experience I have working in the system all this time. And by the way, I'm not a fan of defense attorneys that fit in the categories you've described.
Yeah.
I have my eyes wide open on both of those. And again, we have a system that I've been able to negotiate and navigate in the cases that I work with great success. Are there problems along the way? Of course there are.
Yeah,
have there been nights where you just don't sleep? Of course there are.
Right.
But having been somebody who's working in that system and has worked in that system for, you know, nearly three decades, I can tell you that my eyes are pretty wide open about it, but I also know what the alternatives are. And again, if you do your job up front, and our job is done at jury selection, you've done the right thing, and now you've got a beautiful panel in place that can make the right decisions. If you don't do your job up front, then it's a nightmare you're never going to reconcile. You're going to spend a lot of time on your trial, but it's already been decided because you haven't taken the time to make sure you've got people who don't hold presuppositional biases in one category or another. As a matter of fact, the next book I've written, Forensic Faith, which comes out in May, talks about this jury selection process specifically and how it might be applied to what we typically think of as our efforts to evangelize those around us. There are many great parallels between picking a jury and picking the people you might want to share your faith with, and whether you're going to have any kind of receptive nature of those people at all. That's something you can learn from jury selection process.
Well, all right, Detective Wallace, I really want to thank you for spending so much time with us. Your website, Cold Case Christianity, that's the first book. The second book, God's Crime Scene. Thank you so much for your hard work.
Of course. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. We're looking forward to getting Fred Williams back in the studio. And until then, this is Bob Enyart for Real Science Radio. May God bless you.
Intelligent design and DNA. Scholars can't explain it all away. Get ready to be awed by the handiwork of God. Tune in to Real Science Radio. Turn up the Real Science Radio. Keeping it real. That's what I'm talking about.